Welcome back to the Dealmakers Podcast Show with serial entrepreneur Alejandro Cremades, best-selling author of The Art of Startup Fundraising and co-founder at Panthera Advisors. In this podcast, we ask our guests about their successful acquisitions and financing rounds.
Alrighty, hello everyone and welcome to the Dealmaker Show. So today we have a very exciting founder, you know, a founder that has done it a few times and very successfully. So we're going to be talking about really building, scaling, financing, all of the good stuff, even acquisitions too. You know, his previous company got acquired and we have a very inspiring discussion ahead of us. So without further ado, let's welcome our guest today, BJ Krishnan. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Alejandro. Glad to be here.
So originally born in India, give us a walk through memory lane. How was life growing up over there?
Well, it was good. I lived in a few different cities in India growing up. I got my bachelor's degree at IIT Bombay, studying computer science with a specialization in machine learning. So I've been in the machine learning area for a long time now, about 20 years, long before it was cool. And a bunch of nice work I did there eventually got me accepted into Stanford, and that's when my US journey began.
Well, long before, because AI has been, you know, now everyone is talking about AI. All the founders are saying that their companies have AI, you know, all of that stuff. But what attracted you into the world of artificial intelligence and machine learning to begin with? What got you excited about it?
Yeah, so I really enjoyed a lot of things to do with probability, statistics, mathematical modeling, and concepts of this sort. And it was rather fun to see a lot of those ideas being put to a lot of practical use. At that time, machine learning couldn't quite solve the set of problems it could solve today, but there were still some very, very early signs of cool things it could do, like text categorization, some basic forms of NLP, some part of speech tagging, classifying different data sets, things like that, regression and so on. And it was very exciting to satisfied both maybe some of my nerdy mathematical side and also the pragmatic side. Like, I didn't want to become a pure mathematician or anything like that. While it also had some nice depth to it, that was more or less it in the early days.
So you did the degree in Bombay first, and then eventually you came here for grad school at Stanford. So what got you, you know, to really be excited about the idea of coming to the U.S., you know, to pursue the American dream?
Yeah, at that point, I was very excited about the state of, about machine learning. I had done a bunch of good research, got some nice papers accepted in conferences and journals, which were well cited. And my plan at that point was to go do my PhD in an application of machine learning, very likely to do with text or search or NLP. That was my original intent when I came here. And of course, I applied to a bunch of good universities with strong PhD programs. I was fortunate to get accepted into Stanford. So that's where I came.
Was it like a big culture shock, you know, seeing all the innovation, all the good stuff, you know, happening around you?
I would not call it a culture shock. Yes, there's no doubt that good grad schools like the like Stanford end up having a very high density of the smartest researchers in the world. A lot of the world-renowned faculty members whose textbooks that they author are used in computer science classes all over the world and so on. So it was great. I loved it.
So then eventually you graduate from Stanford and you find yourself in Yahoo. And there in Yahoo, you were part of the AI team. And this was the ultimate, the most immediate step to you becoming a founder. So what were the sequence of events that needed to happen? Because, look, I know that in India, there's tremendous pressure for getting incredible degrees, you know, either becoming an engineer or a doctor. So you definitely were able to check the box on the engineering side. And then also you come to the US and you join a very, you know, credible and reputable company. So, you know, in the eyes of anyone there back in India, they would have thought that you were going absolutely nuts for giving your notice and going into the unknown with launching your first business. So what were those events that needed to unfold for you to feel at peace with the idea of, you know, taking charge of your own destiny?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. You're definitely right about a lot of the things you said here. My immediate family, was very supportive, but you're definitely right about the reaction of a lot of the others. I feel like two things. One is I don't think I have ever been highly subject to social influences. I almost get an internal kick out of cases where I feel like I disagree with a big chunk of the world or with someone else, and I feel I'm right in my view or I have given it enough thought or something else. So I don't think I've been as much subject to social pressure as many others. And second, I think this was, I think we were in the right environment. Like if I had gone to some other grad school, maybe I feel like even if I had gone to MIT, I don't think I would have quite got the kind of exposure. At least in this short time frame, to understand what it takes to translate good technology and good ideas into viable businesses. I think both my co-founder and I were very very excited about this, and I guess at that point they were also investors willing to fund us, and it honestly looked like a no-brainer. I guess my attitude was, what's the worst that can happen? Maybe 2 years later, I'm back at the same job. But that's not a bad place to be.
So you went at it with personalized recommendations. Now, this company, you guys pivoted and rebranded, you know, a bunch of times. What was pushing that? And how hard was every single time you guys pivoted and rebranded the company?
I mean, pivots are certainly expensive, right? Like I think at first, as first-time entrepreneurs, clearly we didn't know everything we happened to learn some years later. Yeah, we did we started off doing personalized search, then we did personalized content recommendations that was largely consumer facing, and then eventually we went on to focus on this in a B2B context, and that is when we got acquired. Yeah, I mean, pivots are certainly not ideal. If it's possible to properly de-risk things, have a five-year view of where the world is going, etc., and if it's possible to march and execute without having too many twists and turns, that's always more desirable. The fact is when you are forced to pivot, you do end up destroying some value in the process.
Well, the good news is that in the process, you guys ended up building something of value. You know that it was perceived of value to others, and in fact, the company ended up getting acquired, and it was reported for $30 million or so. But how was that experience? Because I'm sure that obviously first company, first exit, you know, pretty amazing. But also gaining access to having that visibility into the full cycle of a company, you know, like going from start to finish. So make us insiders. How was like going through that acquisition process?
Yeah, I would say the whole company, right? Like it reminds me of something I think I heard Peter Thiel say, that if you just run a company and failed, you may not learn much about it, because there's probably a lot more ways to fail than the specific way you fail. If you know, somehow you are at the perfectly right place and right time, and you have too much of a smashing success, there may be a lot of key things you do not learn along the way as well. But if you have a fairly difficult time, somewhat bumpy ride, but you manage to make it to the other side, you probably learn a great deal. I think that is probably how I would characterize my experience running our previous startup until the point of acquisition. I think there were a lot of key things, like, for example, focus on markets first above all else, and so on, that the Andreessens of the world were used to saying. But having actually run a company, say, figure out what works, what doesn't work, what creates value, looking at the experiences of fellow founders around me, etc. I think helped me learn at a much deeper level what this whole thing was about, the kind that would have been difficult to learn entirely from books or from this kind of received knowledge.
So once the company got acquired, then you guys say, obviously after that integration, you guys took some time off. And then you thought it was a good idea to perhaps take a look at how were things like on the other side of the table. And you went to Foundation Capital as an entrepreneur in residence. And that was the immediate step to touring. But why did you guys think it was a good idea to experience the VC side of things? And what were you guys doing there?
Well, we basically hung around a little bit there. I think in our specific EIR role, we didn't have very much by way of classic venture firm responsibilities or any of that. We mostly hung around. We the Foundation Capital folks, Ashu and his colleagues, were definitely very helpful to us as we were brainstorming different ideas and everything. So at that point, really, our comparison was, all right, we are doing this. We are figuring out what to do next. In cafes or at home, or we are doing this in the offices of Foundation Capital. And Foundation was actually quite helpful to us. They made a lot of nice connections as we were brainstorming different ideas. They were like, okay, you should probably speak with these five people. I'll make these intros. And all of which was very helpful.
So how was that like? Now, obviously, the second time at it, the first time you did so many pivots and rebrands and, to make sure that you got it right on the product market fit. But now you had a good understanding on when and how, to test and validate whether or not an idea has legs. So how did you guys go about validating the concept, the idea, and incubating it for what would end up becoming touring?
Yeah. Great question. I guess by far our most important learning having run a prior startup was that market factors matter above all else. If you're playing in the right quote-unquote A-plus market, and I'll define A-plus market in a moment, it may be the case that even when you have a somewhat crude MVP, customers love it and they are all over it, just because it solves a very, very important pain point for them, that they have a lot of money to spend to make that pain point go away. I mean, you ideally want to be... ideally, an A-plus market is one where your customers have a very, very severe pain point and have a lot of money to pay to make that specific pain point go away. So, by far, I think the most important thing we learned was that this is something that you want to de-risk. And we spent a lot of, one of the key things we had also learned is that, again, from our previous company, is that once you raise capital and everything, it's a sprint. Like, everybody's measuring you. Based on how fast you're running, the reason startups get valued at a lot of multiples that may seem crazy to some people is that the growth rates are very, very high. And everyone is doing the calculation. Hey, this is growing 3 or 4x every year. If I get in today, even if I pay a crazy multiple, 3 years later, I'll look like a genius given the trajectory this is on. And that is the sort of calculation everybody is doing. So the point is that once you start a company, you want to be in a mode where you're sprinting as hard as you can. And it becomes difficult to engage in this fundamental first principle thinking regarding, should I be in this market at all? Should I be doing this? Should I be doing that? Ideally, you want to try and de-risk that as much as possible. So in our case, I think spending a lot of time talking with different customer clients, understanding the ins and outs of various businesses, etc., were very helpful. At some point, I got curious about the recruiting business. I learned a great deal about the ins and outs of a lot of recruiting businesses of varying sizes. I learned a great deal about IT services business of varying sizes. Also, the unit economics, what the inputs and outputs were. I had friends that were running it who basically told me everything about it. They were perfectly comfortable with sharing relatively more confidential information as well. Talked with execs at large companies, etc. And We talked with prospective clients. We talked with various others. We must have at least had, I would say, 100 plus conversations with various valuable people during those few months, taken notes, developed our thesis better, etc. Before we felt like this is the one company that could become really big. It could become a unicorn. It could even become the next Google.
Hey, guys. So pardon the interruption here. So I got to tell you that, you know, for those of you that are either looking to raise money or you're looking to get your company acquired, you don't have to be alone. You know, there's a lot of psychology that needs to be blended with strategy, with methodology, with process. And it's very hard. And already doing your business alone is super, super difficult. So I remember, you know, back then when I was an entrepreneur, I kept really experiencing the challenge of either knowing or finding the right type of access to the right type of investors, or really understanding what was the right type of guidance, you know, that would carry me through the process, whether it was with seeking money or with going through the acquisition. So that gap that I found being an entrepreneur is ultimately what pushed me later on, when I met my co-founder at Pantera, Mike Severson, to really put together an advisory firm where we are guiding entrepreneurs and founding teams through the capital raising efforts, whether you are at a seed stage or at a Series A stage, or if you are going through the process of an acquisition and you are in small to mid-cap type of a cycle. So again, you know, we would help you from guiding you and supporting you from A to C all the way to the end as an extension of your team. And there's no reason for you to do this alone. So with that being said, if you would like to find out more, feel free to send me an email at alejandro@panteraadvisors.com. And we would love to take a look at helping you out.
Well, let's talk about that moment. When was that moment where you were like, this is it?
Yeah, I would say a few months into it, right? As we were going deeper and deeper into this, we were evaluating some other ideas as well when it comes to applications of AI and machine learning. I think the two key things that swung it in favor of Turing, perhaps not entirely independent of each other, were that number one, there was a very, very strong founder market fit here. So there were other ideas we explored, and having talked with customers and everything, I think we developed a fairly good understanding of them. Like, for example, one of the things we explored was an AI for sales tool, and we considered a few different combinations there. But what we realized was that when it came to this particular problem, there was just a much, much stronger founder market fit. Like in our prior startup, we had worked with a lot of talented software developers in different parts of the world. Like we had worked with talented software developers in Russia, Poland, Serbia, China, Romania, the Middle East, various folks like this. We had had some of these problems firsthand in our prior company. So while we had a Silicon Valley team, they were also supplemented by this distributed team of really talented software developers. And contrary to what everybody said, we could make that collaboration work. And ultimately, the fact that we were getting this A-plus talent from different parts of the world did make the ultimate combination very deadly. I feel like this checked off a lot of valuable boxes. Like you might have heard of, if you've read Peter Thiel's book, 0 to 1, he uses this phrase called secrets. And by secrets, what he means is, what is some profound truth that you understand as a founder that very few people understand, but which could be the basis for a multi-billion dollar business? I think our secret was that we really, really understood the state of remote talent in different parts of the world. We had a strong intuition regarding what quality of talent existed, at what price, how they could be sourced, how they could be vetted, how you could make the remote collaboration itself function. And I think we strongly believed at that point that given the challenges everybody had with local hiring in the US, this was the only way to solve the problem. Like this was our very counter, maybe at the moment it doesn't look all that novel, but at that point it was not a thesis that most people believed. There were a lot of venture capitalists who said, no, this can never work. I feel everybody should sit in the same office. That's the only way work can get done and everything. And a lot of them passed on us, to be fair, in the early days. But The point is, this was the one important thing we strongly felt like we understand this a lot better than most other people in the world. Though we did not predict a pandemic or anything, but we did predict that continuing talent shortages and continuing pressures around that will force companies to go down this route. And the companies who become early adopters here will start gaining a competitive advantage. The others will have to follow suit to not be left behind. And we were going to ride that wave.
So I guess for the people that are listening to really get it, what ended up being the business model of touring? How are you guys making money?
I mean, we are a two-sided platform, right? So on one hand, software developers from countries around the world can sign up. They can take our programming tests, our tests in various tech stacks, and also our skills of our soft skills and leadership skills. That helps us build a detailed profile of them. And the value proposition to them is, if you're a really talented developer, live anywhere you like in the world and still be plugged into the very best job opportunities in the United States and in the world at large. Now, because we have now this value proposition turns out to be very, very appealing in a lot of countries around the world, particularly developing countries. The our value proposition to clients is that we can help you with very, very high quality by cost ratios, either in the context of remote hiring or if you wish to have fully managed software projects run for you. So we do both of these at Turing. And our value proposition is that because we are drawing from this global talent pool, we are subjecting everyone to rigorous vetting. You can have a superstar team comprising the top 1% of the world's software developers in any of these capacities, either if you wish to manage them directly with remote hiring or in a fully managed software project. So at the end of the day, you are going to get very high quality work at very reasonable costs.
So I guess also, how much capital have you guys raised to date?
We've raised something like, I think, 140, 150 million in funding in total.
And I understand that the last valuation on that was 4 billion. That was reported by Forbes, I believe it was, you know, amongst the others, which is really remarkable. I guess how was also the journey of going through all these different rounds and getting those investors involved? Because this was not your first rodeo, so you knew how to go about corporate governance and how to get the right people, you know, when it comes to the structure of the business.
Right. I think the most important thing by far is the number one thing, as I already mentioned to you, is try to make sure it's a business where you're playing in an A-plus market. But if you actually have that out of the way, then the next thing is cash in on that A-plus market and try and get the most rapid growth possible, because growth ends up attracting capital at high valuations, and smart in deployment of that capital can get you even faster growth and in turn attract more good capital at higher valuations. So capital can be a very good, nice sort of multiplier on growth rates. And that's a nice virtuous cycle to be riding when possible. So I would say this is by far the most important thing. Yes, there are certainly a lot of the nitty-gritties when it comes to the compliance and the legalese and everything. But honestly, I think that is less important than this portion. You want to make sure you're carefully managing this capital put in service of growth. Growth in turn going on to raise more capital. And ideally, if you're doing this in an efficient business with excellent unit economics, that rather than a fairly shaky business that is riding on cheap capital, capital can be a great multiplier.
Yeah, no kidding. Now, for you guys, obviously, with capital comes scale. So as you're thinking about scale and looking back, what would you say was the most challenging, you know, thing that you encounter, you know, when scaling up the operations, you know, perhaps globally, and how did you go about overcoming such challenge?
Yeah, so I think a lot of the when you're often a lot of the attractive opportunities in the world when come when you try to do something novel. That because if you're doing the exact same thing as everybody else, you probably don't have much of an alpha to begin with, so to speak. in finance speak, that is. And if you're doing something novel, it's almost by definition it is hard to hire for that kind of a role. Nobody has done a lot of the key things that the role demands. There needs to be a very high degree of first principle thinking, and this is always challenging, right? Like if you look at what most jobs are about in the world, they are very much at this large corporation that has this well-oiled machine, and you know you learn how to pull some specific levers in that as a sort of a cog in the wheel. Now, if you're a startup that is trying to do something novel, that wishes to achieve high growth rates, maintain high growth rates, there's a lot of this needed. This certainly creates some challenges. One more challenge also, which is maybe very closely related to what I just mentioned, is in the fact that a fair amount of constant innovation is needed. It is not like you're overturning your business inside out, but a lot of things in terms of novelty of approaches, etc. Like a certain type of innovation might give you 2 or 4 quarters of growth. But at every stage of growth, you need to think long and hard about what is going to get you the next stage of growth. It again requires this high degree of first principle thinking, novelty, innovation, and all that, which is never easy. And of course, in a business like Turing, there's a lot of other complexity too. We are not a pure tech business. There's operations, there's understanding of various countries, there's understanding a lot of things. But it is precisely that kind of complexity that makes it an attractive opportunity in the first place. If it were very easy, there would probably be a lot of businesses that do this well already.
So obviously, you know, like with the growth and scale, you know, obviously that's what people would typically do. They raise money and they grow like crazy. Now, in your guys' case, I know that capital efficiency has been a really big deal. So I guess how has that approach, you know, perhaps, you know, limited or impacted, you know, the way that you guys have gone about growth?
I would not say it has limited things in any specific way, right? Like there is two ways to think about this, right? Think about capital efficiency itself, right? Like there is one type of capital, one type of instance where you're explicitly sort of being capital efficient and dialing back on growth itself. But you may get capital efficiency simply because your fundamental business is sound, the unit economics are extremely good, and consequently, there is a certain natural kind of capital efficiency which does not really come at the expense of growth. I would very much put Turing's business in that particular category. Like in contrast, right? Maybe let me tell you, what is the other type of business? Again, a lot of good businesses have been built like that, but I think we are playing a much like for example, let's say you have the ride sharing apps, etc. Right? These are businesses that are very, very capital intensive. You're constantly kind of playing chicken with your competitors, trying to drive them off the road and things of that sort. That is not this game at all. Like in here, I think the fundamental unit economics are so good that there's no question of playing any chicken. You could grow at a certain rate without injection of a lot of capital. You could grow at a lot faster rate with the injection of capital. So this again, I would say comes down to the what I just talked about earlier when it comes to A plus markets and secrets. So if you're playing in this A plus market, you're playing in there is something very, very novel you understand about a market and its unit economics and everything, which means there are fewer people maybe executing on this as well as possible. There might exist good opportunities for businesses that are just inherently have excellent unit economics.
Now for this, let me ask you this. You know, obviously with raising money, bringing on investors, bringing on customers, bringing on employees, vision is a really big one. So if you were to go to sleep tonight, Vijay, and you wake up in a world where the vision of Turing is fully realized, what does that world look like?
Well, in that vision of Turing, I guess they would literally be, if that is fully realized, we would probably be as big as Google or Microsoft. Virtually every talent, most hiring, most team formation, most project execution would happen, happen via Turing, almost the same way people go to AWS or GCP or Azure for cloud compute. People would be doing the exact same thing when it comes to talent all the way around the world. It would probably be a world where almost every team is remote distributed, where there's no strong preference for geographic proximity. You just say that I'll let me pull the best 20 people for this job wherever they are in the world. And that's how every team functions by default. And the economic activity itself is nowhere as much constrained by this thing, by borders and physical proximity as it is today.
So let me take you now back in time. I'm going to put you into a time machine, Vijay. You know, we were talking about the future. We're going to talk about the past, but doing so with a lens of reflection. Let's say I put you into a time machine and I bring you back in time to 2008. You know, it's that moment where you're starting to think about a world where you could become an entrepreneur, a world where you could bring a solution to a problem that you were seeing. But let's say, you know, that's the moment where, you know, maybe you just gave your notice at the Yahoo. You know, it's time for you to, it's scary, you know, what you don't know. Well, you don't know, obviously, and you don't know what's in front of you, but you're now leaving the headquarters there, you know, the office where you were working out of Yahoo. And right there, coming out of that building, you know, you're right there, right now, you know, with that younger self. And you're able to stop on the tracks, that younger Vijay. And you're able to have a sit down with that younger Vijay. And you're able to give one piece of advice to that younger self. What would that be and why, you know, when it comes to launching a business?
Oh, it would by far be market above all else. I think it was Andreessen that said that in an A-plus market, even a B-grade team with B-grade technology could do very well. Of course, that's not to say that not to take anything away from A-plus teams and technology, but the fact that the market is a lot more important. While the while an A-plus team with A-plus technology and a B-grade market is probably going to fail or probably going to really struggle to get to some kind of an exit. So my number one message here would really be focusing on the market above all else, particularly focusing on unintuitive market insights that combines a mix of domain knowledge and skill and everything. Certainly, when starting my first company, and as is the case with a lot of people without a lot of industry experience, we tended to focus more on problems that we considered cool and interesting from a research perspective. At that time, for example, I don't think we even gave a lot of thought to, hey, if you wish to do personalized search, is this best done as B2B or is this best done as B2C? If it's B2B, what are we going to charge? Who are we going to sell to? I don't think that thought crossed our mind as much at all. I think it is factors like those that are everything when it comes to whether you can build a giant business or not. And one thing we know, right, from how investors think about these things, that if a company doesn't have any shot at being a unicorn, it's probably not going to even attract a Series A because of the inherently risky nature of investing. The way venture capitalists think about investing is they ask themselves something like, is there at least a 5 or 10% chance something is going to become a unicorn? If so, it might be worth investing in. If it has no chance, then it's probably not something you even want to touch. At that time, maybe one of the things, again, which people had sort of told me, but I don't think I had fully maybe internalized, is that there's no such thing as slow and steady in the technology game. I mean, technology changes so fast. If you're not growing rapidly, it's very, very likely you'll become obsolete in a couple of years. So yeah, market first and speed above all else, speed and growth rate above all else.
So Vijay, for the people that are inspired, that would love to reach out and say hi, what is the best way for them to do so?
They can connect with me on LinkedIn or they can email me at vijay@turing.com.
Easy enough. Well, Vijay, thank you so much for being on the Dealmaker Show today. It has been an honor to have you with us.
Very nice speaking with you, Alejandro.
If you like the show, make sure that you hit that subscribe button. If you could leave a review as well, that would be fantastic. And if you got any value, either from this episode or from the show itself, share it with a friend. Perhaps they also appreciate it. So also remember, that if you need any help, whether it is with your fundraising efforts or with selling your business, you can reach me at alejandro@pantheraadvisors.com.
You've reached the end of another episode of the Dealmakers Podcast. For free resources and materials, head over to alejandrocremades.com. Thank you for listening, and see you at the next episode.